Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as The News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening number, Center Field, by John Fogerty. And we'll be hearing more about baseball music and sports rock later on in Tellier's program, What With the All-Star Game, coming up this Tuesday. And it'll close it out as well.
Well, I spent some time with the Muppet and I.
But first, these trivia questions. Our first trivia question, what's the name of the song that's traditionally played during the seventh inning stretch of baseball games? Hint, the song was first performed as a vaudeville act and first played at a ball game in the 1930s. What's the name of that song? And question number two, what was the slogan of the 1979 World Series championship baseball team, Pittsburgh Pirates, that was also a song title by Sister Sledge? Hint, here's a snippet from that song. Sound familiar? What's the name of that song? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. The transition section of today's program is brought to us by www.musicorb.com. From their series Today in Music History, and today is the weekend of July 8 and 9. If you were born on July 8, you share a birthday with Percy Grainger. He's the composer, pianist, conductor, who was born on July 8th, 1882. And Billy Eckstein, the jazz singer, tenderly, A Fool in Love. He was born on that day back in 1914. Jerry Vale, Arrivederci Roma. He was born on July 8th, 1931. Johnny Johansson, the drummer for the Allman Brothers Band, born on that day back in 1944. Beck was also born on July 8, 1970. Taylor Mayne Pearl Brooks, the daughter of country singer Garth Brooks, was also born on that day, July 8, 1992. Or if you were born on July 9th, you share a B-Day with Buddy Bergman. He's the orchestra leader for the Eddie Fisher Show. He was born on the 9th of July, 1930. Mitch Mitchell, also born on that day. He was the drummer for the Jimi Hendrix Experience. He was born on that day back in 1946. And then Debbie Sledge. She was Sister Sledge of We Are Family fame, born on the 9th of July, 1954. Deaths this weekend include Randall Thompson, no relation, U.S. composer. He died at the age of 85 on this day, the 9th of July, 1984. Events in music history this weekend. Well, back in 1954, Frank Sinatra makes his solo debut with Young at Heart. Rock Around the Clock hits number one on the top 100 chart a year later, 1955. Dick Clark makes his first appearance as host of American Bandstand back a year after that, July 9th, 1956. And Elvis Presley hits number one with Teddy Bear a year after that, 1957. On the 8th of July, Paul McCartney and Wings start their first tour in a double-decker bus on the 9th of July, 1972. Jerry Lee Lewis falls seriously ill after a stomach operation on July 8th, 1981. And the Police hit number one with Every Breath You Take on July 9th, 1983. And finally, the Grateful Dead performed their very last concert with Jerry Garcia on July 9th, 1995.
Arrows of neon and flashing marquees out on Main Street. Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's all on the same street. A typical city involved in a typical daydream. Hang it up and see what tomorrow brings.
Dallas, got a soft machine. Houston, too close to New Orleans.
Jerry Garcia, Grateful Dead. In local rock news, we see this article entitled Salesman Hits TV Again. This is written by Brooke Kane for the News and Observer back on the 21st of June, 2011. Garner. American Idol winner Scotty McCreery isn't the first performer to put Garner on the national pop culture map. Gerald Goodwin, also known as the Singing Salesman, has been a Garner insurance salesman and working entertainer for more than 50 years. Goodwin, who has had his share of time in the spotlight, was featured on the episode of the RFD cable channel's The Shotgun Red Variety Hour. Goodwin's act, a wholesome folksy style of musical comedy, has taken him all over the country for corporate gigs and earned him appearances on Hee Haw and The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. On Hee Haw, Goodwin gave the folks back home a good old Hee Haw salute. Garner, population 10,808. Before I left, he told America in 1983. Goodwin's act mostly consists of him playing the guitar and singing funny but clean songs such as I Just Don't Look Good Naked Anymore and Blue Hairs Driving in My Lane. He mixes in a little family-friendly stand-up and storytelling. I'm 76 years old and I'm still doing it, said Goodwin, a Wake County native who has been doing comedy since his late teens. I think people should know there's another generation out there still active. In his younger days, Goodwin was known for playing his guitar with his left arm slung backwards over his shoulder, behind his back, and reappearing on his right side. That's the double-jointed talent that won him the Hee Haw gig and time on Tokyo television not once, but twice. Back then he called himself the eighth wonder of the world. Now Goodwin sticks to singing and telling jokes. The contortion days are behind him. My goal now is to help people, to make them smile and sing and just be happy, he said. I try to put a positive note in everyone I meet. Everyone in his family has musical talent, Goodwin says. His son James plays multiple instruments and writes country songs. His daughter Denise plays the mandolin and sings, and his wife Anne is the organist at their church near Fuquay Varina. Grandson Jeremy plays bass and sings and writes music, and he works at country music radio station WQDR, where his on-air name is Tucker. Goodwin is traveling to Vermont in August to perform at the Good Sam RV Club's Vermont Samboree. Vermont isn't as exotic as Tokyo, but Goodwin says it's a place he has never been before, so he's excited about the trip. His wife of 54 years isn't making the trip with him, but his choir director is. The two plan to visit Cooperstown, New York, while up north, and to catch a New York Yankees baseball game before heading home again. This next article comes to us by Shirley S. Wang, May the 3rd, 2011, Wall Street Journal. Entitled, Under the Influence, How the Group Changes What We Think. Researchers study what gives social norms their power. How is it that so many people started saying awesome or started wearing Uggs? These are examples of how individuals' behavior is shaped by what people around them consider appropriate, correct, or desirable. Researchers are investigating how human behavioral norms are established in groups and how they evolve over time in hopes of learning how to exert more influence when it comes to promoting health, marketing products, or reducing prejudice. Psychologists are studying how social norms, the often unspoken rules of a group, shape not just our behavior, but also our attitudes. Social norms influence even those preferences considered private, such as what music we like or what policies we support. Interventions that take advantage of already existing group pressures, the thinking goes, should be able to shift attitudes and change behaviors, at least at less cost in effort and resources. Norms serve a basic human social function, helping us distinguish who is in the group and who is an outsider. Behaving in ways the group considers appropriate is a way of demonstrating to others, and to oneself, that one belongs to the group. But surprisingly little is known about how attitudinal norms are established in groups. Why do some people in a group become trendsetters when it comes to ideas and objects? The article skips down and ends with this. In a study published in Science in 2006, participants went to a website and listened to songs, rating and downloading the ones they liked. The 14,000 participants were randomly assigned to different worlds. Individuals in the independent world simply rated and downloaded the songs without any input about what others were doing. In the other 7 dependent worlds, raters saw which songs other participants downloaded and how they rated them. The researchers figured if ratings were based solely on each participant's taste, then the best songs would rise to the top, and all the worlds would mirror the independent world. But if, as they suspected, participants were influenced by others' ratings, then different songs would be rated highest in each world. The researchers found vast variation in rankings between different worlds. Often, which song was rated highly simply depended on who the first raters happened to be. In some circumstances, if you rewound the world and played it again, you could see a potentially different outcome, says Dr. Salganik. The next article is entitled The Story of Music, Part 2. This is from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader, Plunges into Music. Over the last 3,000 years, Western music became steadily more complex and diverse. In Part 2 of our timeline, we provide some highlights of its development. Part 1 was read on an earlier episode of this program. 1000 B.C., psalm singing is a regular part of Jewish worship, and something akin to the hammered dulcimer is being played all over the Middle East. Dulcimer, by the way, comes from the Latin and Greek words dulce and melos, meaning sweet tune. In 600 B.C., the Greek mathematician and philosopher Pythagoras discovers the concept of the octave and develops the first known scale based on mathematical ratios. In 200 B.C., the precursor to the pipe organ is invented in Greece. In 100 A.D., psalms and hymns become part of early Christian masses, and music plays an integral role of the rituals associated with worship. The songs and the rules for singing are believed to have been only taught orally. In 200 A.D., Greek astronomer Ptolemy writes Harmonics, the most substantial treatise on music to date. It outlines a system for determining the proper intervals to create scales, largely based on Pythagoras's work, and the construction of chords, among many other things. In 325 A.D., Roman Emperor Constantine declares Christianity the official religion of the empire. The development of Western music over the next 1,000 years will flow almost exclusively through the church. Other types of music are still being played, but it is the church music that later develops into classical music, and the rules devised in the church that become the basis for music theory. The medieval period, this is from 476 A.D. to 1400. In 525, the Roman scholar Boethius writes his Principles of Music, considered one of the most influential and important books on Western music theory, primarily a reintroduction of ancient Greek musical thought. The book becomes a touchstone for European musical development over the next millennium. One of its innovations is to reintroduce Greek letters to notation with some Roman letters, which will eventually lead to the modern A through G note lettering system. Article skips down. In 810 AD, Charlemagne, Holy Roman Emperor, codifies how chanting, or plain song, is to be performed in the Catholic Mass. Gregorian chanting, often attributed to the 7th century Pope Gregory, is now the church norm. The article skips down and ends with this. Renaissance period, 1400 to 1600. In the 1400s, the printing press is invented, allowing for the much faster spread of musical styles. Composers from what is now northern France, the Netherlands, and Belgium, the Franco-Flemish school, become the most influential of the era with relatively complex polyphonal compositions, mostly written for voice only, though some include music for instruments like the lute and the recorder. In the 1500s, the five-line staff is introduced in France. Sharps and flats are developed, adding new notes to the scale, moving toward the 12 we have today. The organ becomes extremely popular and the guitar is invented. A four-string violin meant to be held on the shoulder and bowed is developed. In 1570, the Florentine Camerati, a group of intellectuals and musicians in northern Italy, begin to meet. Believing that music has become too complex and unintelligible, they set about to correct it and end up inventing opera. Within a few decades, opera becomes one of the most popular styles of music in Europe. Part 3 of this series will be covered in a future program.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
So, what do you know about today's featured genre, sports music, and in particular, baseball music? Well, this from phoenix.about.com. The 2011 edition of the All-Star Game will be the 82nd Midsummer Classic. This will be the first time for both the Arizona Diamondbacks and the city of Phoenix to host the All-Star Game for Major League Baseball. When is this being held? On this coming Tuesday, July the 12th, 2011. The article which inspired this genre and which introduces this genre is entitled The Ultimate Playlist, and it's written by Greg Kelly and published in Sports Illustrated on July 4, 2011. What are the best sports songs of all time? It's time to face the music. Music and sports are so intertwined it's hard to imagine one without the other. Boston fans sing Tessie and Sweet Caroline to rally the Red Sox. The Alan Parsons Project greets the Bulls, one shining moment, gift wraps the Final Four. The action on the field has a built-in soundtrack, a perfect score. It works the other way, too. Sports is infused in music as much as music is infused in sports. Last year, John Fogerty was honored at the National Baseball Hall of Fame on the 25th anniversary of Center Field, which opened today's program, by the way. This month, singer-songwriter Terry Cashman will receive the same nod for Talkin' Baseball. In recent years, Fenway Park has been a literal bandbox, hosting shows by Springsteen and the Stones, among others. In 2005, Jimmy Buffett, a monster Cubs fan and part owner of a minor league team, played the first concert at Wrigley Field. Joe Frazier crooned, Bernie Williams strums, Ronit Artest and Kobe Bryant rap, unfortunately, and former defensive tackle Mike Reed churns out beautiful country melodies, and the list of artists with sports-themed songs spans the breadth of popular music. Bob Dylan, Jay-Z, Woody Guthrie, Lead Belly, Common New Order, Miles Davis, The Pogues, Snoop Dogg, and on and on. This is the rich vein from which SI has mined its first collection of sports' greatest hits. These aren't stadium anthems, no Gary Glitter here, or novelty, sorry, Super Bowl Shuffle. These are songs by serious artists who use sports as subject and metaphor, rated for both the music and their message. Many are by great storytellers with wonderful tales to tell. The philosopher Umberto Eco said, "We like lists because they bring order to chaos and make us feel immortal. And we know that rock and roll will never die. Read on, then, and live forever." The number one song listed is Who Killed Davy Moore by Bob Dylan, 1963. This is a song about a boxer. The always enigmatic Dylan said when he introduced this ballad at his landmark Lincoln Center performance in 1964, it's got nothing to do with boxing. That's true in the same way that Moby Dick has nothing to do with whaling. Still, Who Killed Davy Moore remains a serious indictment of the fight game to this day. Number two, Surfin' USA, The Beach Boys, 1963. Think about where surfing would be without the Beach Boys. Number three, All Kinds of Time, Fountains of Wayne, 2003. It begins with a sports writing cliche, a young quarterback with all kinds of time, and turns into a moving ballad about youth, zen, calm, and coming through in the clutch. Number four, Racing in the Streets, Bruce Springsteen, 1978. I wanted my street racers to carry the years between the car songs of the 60s and 1978 America, Springsteen wrote. And number seven, The Boxer, Simon and Garfunkel, 1969. When New York City was knocked into the canvas in the weeks after September 11, 2001, Paul Simon played this classic about a troubled pugilist on the first episode of Saturday Night Live following the terrorist attacks. Simon sings that, despite being discouraged and down on his luck, the fighter still remains and refuses to leave the city. The perfect message of perseverance for a country struggling to get back on its feet after absorbing a brutal blow. Simon told Playboy in 1984 that the boxer in the song was really a metaphor for himself, a way of describing his reaction when the enormously popular Simon and Art Garfunkel started to get negative feedback from music critics in the late 1960s. "Everybody's beating me up," he said, "and I'm telling you now, I'm going to go away if you don't stop." Coming in at number six, 50 Mission Cap, the tragically hip 1992 song. This clever rocker tells the story of Bill Borico, a Maple Leafs defenseman who scored only 5 goals in 47 career playoff games but made his last one count. He won the 1951 Stanley Cup with an overtime score against the Canadiens. And coming in at number seven, John Fogerty's 1985 hit Center Field, which opened today's program, by the way. He says, "I remember the idea of center field I'd had as a kid, because when he was growing up, my dad and uncles would talk about Joe DiMaggio, and their eyes would get really big. And I got the idea that center field at Yankee Stadium must be the center of the universe and the coolest of all places." I said, "That's it. I want to be in center field." Number eight, High Expectations, Common, 1997. The Chicago-born rapper gets inside the head of a high school hoop star and presents a haunting interior monologue about the promises and pitfalls of being an NBA wannabe. Number nine's another baseball one, Third Base, comma, Dodger Stadium. This is by Ry Cooder, 2005. Number 10, a boxing one, Muhammad Ali by Faithless, 2001. Number 11, soccer, God's Footballer by Billy Bragg, 1991. Number 12, Boom Boom Mancini, Warren Zevon, 1987. Number 13, Duck Koo Kim, Sun Kil Moon, 2003. Those last two both being boxing songs, as is number 14. And number 14's about boxing, Song for Sonny Liston by Mark Knopfler, 2004. And coming in at number 15...
Sitting on the top of everything, sweetly irritating.
The Ballad of Bjorn Borg by the Pernice Brothers, 2001. Borg won 11 Grand Slam titles, but it's easy to forget how quickly he flamed out. He won his last major tennis tournament the day after his 25th birthday and played only 3 times after that, sleepwalking into early retirement. Coming in at number 16, Boxing Again. That's the title of it. Ben Folds 5, 1995. Number 17, finally get one into racing. This is Speedway at Nazareth by Mark Knopfler, 2000. Number 18, Fugue for Tin Horns. This is from Guys and Dolls, 1950. There's never been a better tribute to the degenerate horse player, and never will be. This nails the gambler's perpetual, or is it misguided optimism? Coming in at number 19, Tournament of Hearts, The Weaker Thens, from 2007. And this one is once again about curling, of all things. Number 20 is Tessie, Dropkick Murphys, from 2004. 21 is called Hockey by Jane Syberry, 1989. Number 22, The Hitter by Bruce Springsteen, 2005. The Hitter is right out of John Steinbeck. It follows the rise of a fictional Depression-era fighter and then his crushing downward spiral. Number 23 is an American football one called Queen's Gambit. 24, The Laughing River by Robert Earl Keane and Greg Brown, 2009. And it's a career minor leaguer's lament. Number 25, Mud Football by Jack Johnson, 2001. There's a kind of pickup game in the mud that everybody remembers fondly. Number 26, The Dream Team by Spearhead, 1994. This is embracing the Olympic Dream Team of 1992. Number 27, Munich Air Disaster, 1958 by Morrissey, 2004. 28, A Dying Cub Fan's Last Request by Steve Goodman, 1983. Number 29, Shooting Hoops by G. Love and Special Sauce, 1994, about basketball, of course. Number 30, The Warrior's Code by Dropkick Murphys, 2005. Once again, this is about baseball. 31, entitled Basketball by Curtis Blow, 1984. 32, Daryl Dawkins' Sound of Love by Screaming Headless Torsos, 2001. And coming in at number 33, a sailing song, Chesapeake by Mike Aiken, 2003.
We ain't stealing, we're just taking back. Very simple statement of fact.
There are hundreds of sailing shanties, and there's Christopher Cross's Sailing and Jimmy Buffett's Take It Back, which is playing in the background. The best and perhaps only America Cup rooting song. 34 is Van Lingo Mungo, Dave Frischberg, 1969, about baseball. 35 is Stewball. This is about a horse, of course, a racer. Leadbelly, 1940. Number 36, America's Favorite Pastime by Todd Snyder, 2009. Number 37, Let the Big Horse Run by John Stewart. This is, of course, Secretariat, 1975. 38, Did You See Jackie Robinson Hit That Ball by Buddy Johnson Orchestra, 1949. And number 39, The Ballad of Eddie Klepp, Chuck Brodsky, 1996. This is about the first and only white player to appear in the Negro Leagues. And finally, number 40, Levitate by Bruce Hornsby, 2009, basketball theme. So how'd you do on the trivia questions? The first answer was Take Me Out to the Ball Game. That's the seventh inning stretch song. And answer number two was We Are Family, led by Pops Willie Stargell, 1979 World Series, Pittsburgh Pirates, 1971. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.